rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border. Roche pressed to let others make Tamiflu. This Julie Schmitz column in USA Today. What happens when corporations don't serve the community first? You know, the corporate form in the United States has a long and storied history, as they say. But it also has a... You go back to the beginning, and the history of the corporate form was a corporation from the beginning of this country, when they first threw out the British East India Company, which actually controlled most of the states, and the revolt against the British East India Company began in 1773 with the Boston Tea Party, and was the main force, the main driving force behind the American Revolution. Was the colonists standing up and saying, essentially, we don't want those stinking Walmart here. Because that's what the East India Company was in its day. It was the Walmart of its day. It was the huge multinational corporation that provided everything. And that inhaled small entrepreneurial ventures, wiped them out, put the, you know, just did away with it all over the place. From that time until just after the Civil War, for all practical purposes, really the 1780s, 1790s, 1770s, depending on which state you're looking at, because corporations are generally regulated at the state level. So, more or less, for the first 100 years of the life of this country, a corporation could not be chartered easily. In fact, in every state, up until the 1760s, in every state, if you wanted to create a corporation, you had to get a senator or a member of the House of Representatives at the state level to introduce a bill into the state House of Representatives, the state Senate. It had to pass, say it was a senator, it had to pass the Senate, then it goes to the House, it had to pass the House, then it had to go to the governor had to sign it, and now you've got a corporation. That's what it took in the United States to make a corporation. From the beginning of this country up until the beginning of the robber baron era. Then, in order to get that bill passed through the legislature, you had to state how this corporation was going to serve the public good. We're going to build the Erie Canal. We're going to build a railroad. We're going to build a steel factory. And here's how it's going to help the public good. You had to assert what the public good was. The corporation couldn't exist for more than 20, 30, 40 years at the most. In some states, not more than 10 years. Before its assets had to be dissolved, taxes had to be paid on them, the corporate equivalent of an inheritance tax. And the incorporators had to start all over again. Every year, the Secretary of State in every state had to look at those corporations and say, is this corporation serving the public good or not? And if it's not serving the public good, then, you know, how do we make it serve the public good? What do we have to do? Well, and it was against the law for corporations to own other corporations. A corporation could only do a single function. It was against the law for corporations to involve themselves in politics. Corporations were and still are legally semi-public entities. They're not entirely private entities. Say, well, this is a private corporation. We have the right to not tell you how your vote is being counted because we're a private for-profit corporation here making this vote counting software. Well, no, you're not entirely private and for-profit. You are also a public corporation because the act of granting limited liability to a corporation is the result of a public act. That is the allowing of the incorporation. Now we do it through Secretary of State's office. It doesn't require an act of legislature anymore. But it still is a corporation is a public-private institution. So Senator Charles Schumer, the Democrat from New York, yesterday asked the Swiss corporation, Roche, which manufactures Tamiflu, the only drug so far that's known to be able to fight the bird flu virus. And even at that, it doesn't cure the thing. We're not talking a vaccine here. We're simply talking about a drug that may cause people to get very, very sick instead of die. Charles Schumer asked the Swiss company, Roche, if their patent which allows them to exclusively manufacture this drug, if they would mind suspending their patent between now and 2016 when it expires, so that other countries and other pharmaceutical companies could start mass-producing Tamiflu. Roche had no comment, but said Friday, this quoting from USA Today, but had said Friday, the week before, that it intends to remain Tamiflu's sole maker, although it is looking into ways to expand production. And they say because Tamiflu is hard to make, Roche says a new drug maker would need 3 years to produce Tamiflu. Schumer says companies in Taiwan and India are prepared to begin production now. At what point do we say, you know, the public good is a pretty high value for us. It's a pretty important thing. It's a very important thing, in fact, the public good. And if a corporation isn't going to serve that public good, then, you know, we need to ask ourselves at some level, is this a corporation we want to continue to authorize to do business? In a time of a pandemic, in a time of a disease that not just could, but does, let's say it reaches that point, kill millions, kill perhaps billions. Is that a time for us to say, you know, this strange set of privileges and powers that we've given corporations over the last 100 years that they never had before in the United States, although they did have back in Victorian England, but that was what we rebelled against, you'll recall, or pre-Victorian England. Elizabethan England. That was what we were, and Georgian England. That's what we rebelled against, you'll recall. That we should suspend these kind of recent silly rules that folks like John Roberts and Harriet Myers, the corporate attorneys, are also gung-ho and in favor of, that give corporations rights. And instead say, no, we're going to give corporations privileges, and you know, if you're going to be in the public sphere, if you're going to be doing things that make money, hopefully, do good things, but also you must serve some public function. You must be doing something that serves the public good. You must. We're not going to let you just, you know, pretend that you have no role to play in all this. I think this is, you know, pretty important stuff. Scott in Breezewood, Pennsylvania, on the line. Welcome to the program, Scott. What's up?
Thank you. I totally agree with you on this. The corporations have completely forgot about, all they care about is money. I mean, anybody that doesn't believe that, I mean, they've been living under a rock.
Well, let me take it a step beyond that, Scott. The Supreme Court about 15, 20 years ago ruled that if a corporation thinks about anything other than money, their officers can be held guilty for a crime. In other words, if you as an officer or a director of a corporation do something charitable and you can't prove that that charitable act is actually going to make more profit for your corporation than it earns you, you've broken the law. The first main purpose
wrong.
Of a corporation has to be to make money.
Yeah, that's totally wrong. I mean, we've destroyed the Constitution. I mean, nobody ever even reads the Constitution anymore in school and stuff. And that used to be a requirement when I went to school, is at least you read the document. I mean, nowadays, the only parts that people pick up is when it's on a movie. They pick up little pieces here and there, like on National Treasure, great example, where he says in the Declaration of Independence, it says those that have the ability to act have the responsibility to act. And I mean, the greatest example of that not being true anymore was that Toledo riot. There was 300 people standing around while these people broke into a house. I mean, everybody knows that it's not okay to kick in somebody's door and go in and steal their stuff and light their place on fire. But yet they all stood around and just watched it.
Yeah.
I mean, I so much wanted to be there just to stand in front of that door and say, no, you're going to go through this door through me.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, people...
There comes a time essentially, Scott, I think you're saying, and there comes a time when we all have to stand up and say, enough.
Yeah.
And if you have one company in the world...
to us, then something has to change. Because
yeah.
we're the ones that elect them. And
yeah.
all of a sudden, when they get there, all of a sudden it's all about money. And how much money can I get? And can I get reelected? And can I stay here for just enough time so I can get the big retirement and cash in and not have to do anything and just go around and...
And that's the political process. And you make a good point, Scott. But let's take this the next step. What about the corporate process? Corporations don't run for political office. Nobody elects them. Anybody can start a corporation. You can start one. I can start one. I've started seven of them in my life. I've actually started more than that, but I've had seven that have grown to be successful companies. Five of them are still, you know, in existence out there running, making money for people and whatnot. A couple are nonprofits, actually. But at what point do we say to, for example, Roche, you know, hey, we think it's a fine thing that you came up with Tamiflu. You figured out a way to take an extract of a plant, an Indian plant called Star Anise, or a Chinese plant called Star Anise, that you could take this extract of this plant and turn it into an antiviral drug. We think that's marvelous. We're all in favor of that. And you should make money on it. However, there's a billion people's lives at stake here. I mean, there are companies in India, and the government of India has, you know, for all practical purposes, announced that they're going to start. They're just going to say, hey, you know, we don't care what you're doing. We're going to start making these stuff. We're going to start making these products anyway. You know, we're just going to go ahead and do it. We're going to reverse engineer the, like, see, this is the thing that they went through with the AIDS drugs a while ago, and this is the same thing. With the whole thing about, you know, reverse engineering the AIDS drugs and taking a pill that would cost $10, $20, $30, I mean, a month's income for somebody in India that actually has a manufactured cost of maybe 4 cents. How much should that be sold for in India if it really is a matter of life and death? These are serious questions that we need to be confronting as a society, and nobody is talking about these things, frankly. Certainly not in the mainstream press. Not at all. I mean, this is short article. Julie Smith actually raised these things in USA Today. The pressure on Roche is similar to that Bayer faced in 2001 over its antibiotic Cipro after anthrax scares in the USA. Bayer ended up tripling production and lowered the price of the drug. But again, still, you know, they didn't go out and say, well, here it is generic. But we didn't have an anthrax epidemic in the United States. I mean, this is a whole level of difference. Are we going to have a billion people die so that one company can make more profit? I suspect that there are people, if we got somebody on from the Competitive Enterprise Institute who would say, or the Ayn Rand group who would say, yeah, that's the market. But welcome to it. 18 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
He took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. And charged the people a dollar and a half to see them.
And welcome back, my friends. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, where you can get the latest iPods, all things Macintosh, and even PCs and all sorts of other computer help, computer assistance, computer products. Check them out on the web, also at smalldog.com, 1-800-511-MACS. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, don't think so. Really don't think so. Tom in Greenville, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I appreciate you taking my phone call. I'm just calling just because I'm a little bit surprised that you're criticizing Roche Pharmaceuticals. If they're willing to basically license their product out to other companies, then what's the harm?
There would be no harm. They have not said that they're willing to. What they've said is that they are looking into ways that they can expand their own production. In fact, the industry's trade association said, and I'm quoting here from the USA Today, forcing Roche to license Tamiflu could discourage others from investing in anti-flu drugs. Now, you know, I think that Roche should be compensated. If Roche is sitting on something, if bird flu does mutate into the human form, and if Tamiflu is effective against it, Roche could end up being, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. I mean, Roche could end up being sitting on trillions of dollars. I mean, this could be huge. And at the same time, they could be the arbiters of life and death all over the planet. And so, I don't even think Roche wants to be that. But I do think that they should be compensated in some way. I think the governments should be saying, hey, you know, we will pay you in some way, in some form for this. But the problem is that right now, because of patent laws and because of the way that the laws have been set up, which in many ways are really good things for good purposes, because they do encourage, you know, the development of new products. We have a situation where it may well be that just the very wealthy and just a small number of countries will be able to survive an epidemic that could kill billions. And, you know, I got a problem with that. And I'm not saying that Roche is the villain here. Is Schumer coming out and asking them to temporarily suspend the patent is a start. He also says that Roche should be compensated for the Tamiflu that they're not going to be making. The devil, of course, is going to be in the details. But, Tom, you raise a good question. Thank you. Thank you so much for doing it. Mike in Indianapolis, you're live and on the air. Hey, thanks for calling the Tom Hartmann program.
Okay. Hey, Tom. I was really glad to hear you say that the suspension of these patents wasn't necessarily all a bad thing, because it sounded like to me when I first heard you that you were really coming down on these corporations hard and heavy. It looks like you've changed your opinion somewhat.
A bunch of corporations in my life. I've run a bunch of them. I've done business with corporations. This program is a corporation. It's being carried on networks by corporations. I have nothing against corporations. What I have against is my problem in general is corporations claiming the same rights as human beings. That's a larger issue. It kind of goes beyond this. In the case of Roche and Tamiflu, however, I think that we're confronted with an ethical dilemma. And it's, you know, the free market collides with the commons and humanity.
So. Well, you're exactly right, but I still think we've got to give a preference to corporations somewhat, just because of all the good that they manage to do in society. And I think if the government oversteps their bounds, it's like anything else.
But corporations don't do good in society. Corporations make money. If making money helps society, that's a fine thing. But the purpose of a corporation is not to do good in society. No, you're not even supposed to start a corporation to do good in society. You can start a nonprofit to do good in society.
But the thing about that is, I would say this: if you start a corporation, you're not doing good for society in some form or the other. With the capitalist system that we have, you're going to fail as a corporation.
I wish that was true. But if that was true, the tobacco companies would have been out of business a long, long time ago. The reality is that it used to be that that was a requirement. You had to prove that you were doing good for society to stay as a corporation, but it's no longer a requirement. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartmann.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained, and rode us all the way into New Orleans.
And welcome back, my friends.
I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. When she wiped her slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew.
Some bumper music, you just gotta let it run.
Another word for nothing left to lose.
There you go. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Welcome back, 9:35. Let's talk about losing. Let's talk about losing freedom, losing hope in times, in difficult times as we face today. Paul Loeb is with us. Paul is the author of many, many fine books. Soul of a Citizen, one of his earliest and most famous, soulofacitizen.org, the website for that. His most recent, The Impossible, will take a little while. A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, really glad to be here.
It's so nice having you right here in the studio with us. What's the website for The Impossible?
TheImpossible.org. Easy to spell, easy to remember.
TheImpossible.org.
That's right.
Okay. Here we are living in times when a lot of people are experiencing a lot of despair. They look at the Bush administration taking apart the environment, taking apart FEMA, taking apart the social safety net. You get Rush Limbaugh out there saying that he's unambiguous. That it's all about let's destroy Social Security, Roosevelt's number one project, the conservative agenda. No bones about it. I mean,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
I mean, you hear this and you hear all, faux news and Fox News and the coverage of New Orleans, where it flipped so quickly from a humanitarian crisis to a black folks gone wild kind of coverage, playing on the worst racial stereotypes, all these kinds of things. I think a lot of people are like, oh, no, a lot of people are let's just listen to music or something. I mean, they're tuning out of the political process. At the same time, a lot of people are getting into the political process, but they're getting into it with such rage or such fear that it may even be counterproductive. What's your take on all this, Paul?
Well, I mean, it's very easy to feel down. It's very easy to feel overwhelmed. And it's true. You get involved. You're just furious at the SOBs. And then suddenly there you are. And you think after a little while and you think, okay, my anger is exhausted. Where do I go now? And the challenge is to be able to say in any kind of movement for change, it's got to be long haul. And that's how you begin to transform things. I mean, the title of the book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, is exactly because the impossible is not impossible, but doesn't always arrive the next day, the next week. And if you look at our greatest heroes, even, they didn't start and suddenly leap full-blown onto a historical stage. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Rosa Parks, Nelson Mandela, Václav Havel, King. There are all, I love the story about King, a friend of mine. Martin Luther King, one of his professors speak, and said, well, King, he got a C in his philosophy class at Morehouse College. And she said, I thought that was great because if he can get a C in his philosophy class and go on to be Martin Luther King, anything is possible for the rest of us. And we think that, again, that it's these sort of golden people. What we have to recognize is that when change comes, it comes from the persistence of keeping on, not knowing. There's a phrase in the book from Jim Wallis, the wonderful minister from Sojourners. He says, hope is believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change by our actions. So you have a situation. It looks bad. It looks difficult. And then because you act to take a stand, it begins to be transformed. And we don't always know, Howard Zinn talks about the optimism of uncertainty, the sense that you can look at a historical moment and everything is absolutely certain. You think, oh, here are these dictatorships in Eastern Europe. They're going to persist for 30, 50, 70 years. And then an electrician at a shipyard in Poland with some of his fellow workers starts taking a stand. And then something leaps. Mandela calls it the multiplication of courage. Something leaps from one person inspiring another to inspiring another. And then all of a sudden, you see these visible events on the world stage, but it's all those sort of lower, more subtle, less heralded, less dramatic events that always lead up to them. And those are the events that all of us participate in.
In a way, it's not that we owe our success to the fact that we stand on the shoulders of giants. It's that the giants
stand on the shoulders of all the rest of us.
That's right. That's right. Let's flip that model upside down.
Yeah, in fact, exactly so.
There are so many people who are, you're famous. You're an author. You're on the radio. You're giving a speech, whatever.
Right.
Somebody's a civil rights leader. Or they're a movement leader, a politician, an elected official. They must be special. There must be some. I could never do that.
Right.
I could never be like that. Look at that, Rosa Parks. I mean, yeah. Rosa. Even if I stood up and said to the bus driver, they just kicked me off the bus. I mean, it's not going to start a movement. I'm not Rosa Parks.
Right. And what we don't know about Parks, which I write about in The Impossible Will Take a Little While, is that she didn't start that day on the bus. She had been an activist in the NAACP for 12 years at that point. She was the secretary of the local chapter, taking minutes of the meetings. You didn't see the network news camera zooming in saying, Rosa Parks is making history. She's taking minutes at a meeting. But that's part of what makes history. It builds that structure that was there to respond after her stand on the bus. She was part of a whole community. It didn't just happen accidentally because her feet were tired or something. She'd taken trainings at a labor and civil rights center called Highlander School that's still there to this day in Tennessee. She'd met with a whole other generation of civil rights leaders. She learned from people, and that's always the case. It isn't as if suddenly we act out of nowhere or we act alone in isolation. We act in a community with others, building on their work, and then we keep on. I mean, she was, again, think about it, if she'd given up in year 3 or 5 or 7 or 10, we would never have heard of Rosa Parks. But she kept on, and a dozen years after her first NAACP meeting, which, by the way, came out of very dark times and dark issues. It was they were looking at lynching and that kind of thing, you know, where to... Survival issues, where even to participate in a meeting was to risk the same fate. And we think, you know, these are hard times now, but I don't think it's comparable to trying to take on lynching in the South of the early, of the 1940s. And out of that, something leaps, and a movement for justice moves forward. And that's always the way that occurs.
Yeah. Let me just, by the way, referring back to the first half hour, one of the folks in the chat room, and if you want to drop into our live chat room, and it's in front of me all the time when I'm on the air, and some of the finest minds in the entire Internet hanging out there, and some of the strangest, too. You know who I'm talking about on there. one of the folks in the chat room pointed out to me that Roche, a Reuters story, in fact, she gave me the link for it, Roche has said that they are willing to license Tamiflu. So we'll see how that, we'll see where that goes. But, you know, that's a whole other issue that, you know, again, and it could be a source for despair or it could be a source for political action. I mean, this is the Bush administration.
I mean, if you have popular pressure saying this is literally a matter of life and death, you have to act on it. It's not going to be an abstracted benevolence. I mean, sometimes that happens. But generally what's going to occur is to move a huge institution like a company like Roche. It's going to be a global outcry. And a lot of times we don't know what our actions are going to produce. And there's an example from Vietnam where huge march during the Nixon era, decentralized events called a moratorium in every community in the country. And publicly Nixon said, I'm watching the Washington Redskins football game. This isn't going to affect me. I'm not going to listen to a bunch of hippies. Privately, what he conceded is that, in fact, he was making plans to potentially use nuclear weapons in North Vietnam and didn't because of the fear of what was the popular response. So there was an interesting case where people were having frustration because they felt that their actions, in fact, were doing no good at a point where they actually may have, our actions may have stopped the use of nuclear weapons on a human populace.
They may have saved the world.
May have saved the world, yeah. I mean, a hugely powerful impact, but we don't always know that impact. And it's relatively rare that the powers that be are going to signal us and say, thank you so much for standing up and speaking out. You've made us do this. Now, if you just keep on a little longer, you're going to make us do something else.
It's not just rare. It's unheard of.
It's basically unheard of, yes.
And yet that's how it happens. I mean, you know, not wanting to overuse, you know, over cliche Margaret Mead's quote, but that's really how it happens. You tell the story about how Benjamin Spock got involved in the anti-war movement.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. Spock was, if people don't know, is the most, probably, he wrote Baby and Child Care, was probably the most famous doctor in the world, or next to Jonas Salk of the polio vaccine. And a friend of mine in the early 60s was in a tiny vigil in Washington, D.C. She was a widow with 3 kids, brought her kids. It was raining. They were just demoralized. I mean, this is not going to do any good. They're sitting out there in the rain. Why are we doing this? Everybody who acts has those moments of despair. And a few years later, she's had a huge rally on the same issues. And Benjamin Spock is speaking. And he's talking about his journey into involvement. He talks about the issues, of course. But he says, what really got me involved, what really changed me is one day in Washington, D.C., this tiny group of people, I was passing the White House. I saw these group of women with their kids. I went over to see what they were talking about. And I realized, if they are so concerned, maybe I better do something. And my friend, sitting out there, realized that was the moment when she had felt so powerless that, in fact, she was having an impact in bringing into involvement somebody who would influence hundreds of thousands of others.
That's a remarkable story. It's an absolutely remarkable story, and she never would have known.
And she never would have known. It was completely accidental. Just in the same way that if you look at Parks and you ask who got her involved, well, we know that it was her husband, Raymond Parks, played a key role because he was involved in the NAACP before her. If we ask who got Raymond Parks involved, we don't know the answer. Some unknown person got Raymond Parks involved. He got his wife involved, who no one had heard of. A dozen years later, something happens that everybody acknowledges is making global history.
And so, ultimately, the challenge is for each one of us to step out, to speak out, to participate. And if we do that, then we do bring about the change. It's not a cliche. It's not glib talk. It's not happy talk. Optimism of the week. You know, every day in every way I am getting better. No, this is actually how every significant change in history has happened.
Right. And we don't always know exactly how things are going to play out. Havel says hope is not prognostication.
Havel.
It's not foretelling the future. It's an orientation of the heart that says, let's recognize that our actions are going to determine the future. I mean, that's the core theme of The Impossible. Will take a little while. That we don't know exactly what history is going to do. None of us are able to do that. We're not fortune tellers. But what we do know is that when you take together all those unknown, unheralded actions together, that's what creates historical change.
We're talking with Paul Loeb. Paul is the author of The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear, theimpossible.org, the website. And, Paul, stick around. Well, let's take a couple of phone calls together.
Sounds
here.
Sounds good to me.
See what people have to say here. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, or tomhartman.com.
Hurry, supplies are limited.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, good old Ahmed, yes. Yeah, you just sold us out a little.
Remember back in a month, they found the money was gone. So you fled from the country as fast as you could, and you found yourself valuable friends. Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz knew you were ready to swim.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, the song of good old Mr. Shalabi. Let us not forget Ahmed Shalabi, convicted of bank swindling in Jordan, sentenced to 27 years of hard labor, but the Bush administration based the war in Iraq on his information, and he's now arguably the number two or three guy in the country in charge of all the oil that we so badly need. Amazing. Amazing. Paul Loeb is with me. Paul, the author of his most recent book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. And I should add, Paul, a good friend of mine, a dear friend, and I'm just so glad you're here, Paul. It's great to see you and great to have you in the studio with us. Let's take some phone calls. Up for you? Are you up for that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Blaine in Sacramento, California is on the line. Hey, Blaine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I love your show. I just wanted to say that. I've been listening for, I don't know, a couple of weeks now since you've been in Sacramento. And
on 1240 Talk City in Sacramento. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
And you're just a wealth of information. And what a caller a week or so ago said, it's like sitting down and having a beer with your favorite history teacher. And that's exactly a great way to describe you. So, but what I have is just a question that maybe Mr. Loeb can answer. I'm just a mom who, you know, has gotten active in a small way, what I think is a small way. And I never went to a rally before George Bush was elected. I never really sent letters. But that's something that I'm starting to do now. But my question is, there's so many different organizations that are out there trying to do good, and it gets overwhelming to know who to, you know, join up with or support. I'm looking for, like, something that, an umbrella issue. Is there something like that that would cover all of these, or affect in a positive way all these other little grassroots type organizations?
Good question, Blaine.
Good question, yeah. I mean, I think it's easy. There's at one point I talk about a perfect standard where people wait for that perfect moment, perfect issue, perfect angle, perfect time in their lives, and then the ones who act realize that there is no perfect time or perfect point. You get in as best you can. And in terms of the issue, I mean, I would, you know, you almost any progressive issue leads into the others. I mean, certainly a group like MoveOn.org, which I work with fairly closely, embodies a whole lot of different issues. And one of the things that I appreciate that they're now doing is that they're trying to actually localize it. So, for instance, I was at a vigil, one of the Cindy Sheehan vigils, where you punch in your zip code. This was organized by a woman whose husband's over in Iraq, the one in my neighborhood. And, you know, you're able to go and connect with your neighbors. So what I would try and do is Sacramento has a lot of good progressive citizen groups, is to try out a good peace group, a good social justice group, so again, something like Move On, and start and just see and kind of feel it as you go and be able to learn and say, all right, here it is. I'm going to meet with a bunch of ordinary citizens. And, you know, maybe there'll be a few flakes as well. But by and large, you'll end up connecting with some really good and powerful people. And the other thing I think is to recognize when we're just getting started, it's really easy to get overwhelmed. Like you sort of open the door and the horrors flood in. It's like, I guess, Pandora's box in reverse or something like that. And
right.
And you just think, oh, no, I don't even want to think about all these things. How can I do this? And then recognize that the people who, in fact, do it for the long haul, they find ways to be able to enjoy that act of working with a bunch of good people. I remember seeing Desmond Tutu in Los Angeles not too long ago, and certainly Tutu's been up against the hardest, as you could imagine, apartheid, speaking against the war, working in Rwanda. And you might think he's kind of bitter and downhearted, yet if you see him, he's really delightful, and he's joking, he's laughing, he's teasing, and this was a benefit in Los Angeles, and he was kind of feeling ill, so he lay down to give a nap, and then he got up, gave his talk, some other people spoke, and some music started playing, and all of a sudden, I look over, and here's Desmond Tutu dancing right in the middle of the dance floor. And I'm thinking, I've never seen a Nobel Peace Prize winner dance before. This is interesting. And the lesson to me is, well, maybe not all of us going to end up Nobel Peace Prize winners, but we can enjoy this process. We can savor the good company of the other people we meet and work with. And we can mesh that sort of enjoyment of life with that passion that drives us to act for justice. And I think if we do that, that's what allows us to keep on for the long haul, as opposed to getting so despairing and embittered by the very real difficult issues that we take on.
And Blaine, in addition to looking at local organizations, Democracy for America, whatnot, don't forget the political parties. The Republican Party,
absolutely,
the Democratic Party, the Green Party, you know, that's where so much local action is taking place. And so much of it is happening in bad ways and in ways that we despair of, because people like you and I and Paul are not joining, are not showing
absolutely
up for the meetings, are not participating. So, you know, get involved in at least one of your local political parties. Paul, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's always great to see you, my friend. And so glad you could actually make it by the studio here. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The radio support group of, by, and for we the people. Viagra for your brain, where being progressive never felt so good. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast. Welcome back to our program. In just a moment, we're going to be speaking with Jeremy Narby, our Bioneers segment for the day. Jeremy, a Swiss-based anthropologist and indigenous land rights activist. I'll tell you more about him in just a moment. But first, I just wanted to wrap up a couple of phone calls that are on the topic of the previous hour, and just to kind of close some of these things out, because that was a fairly important topic. Colleen in Coos Bay, Oregon, listening on KBBR. Hey, Colleen.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I was just listening to Paul, and I was just thought it was a good time to call because it is so important to, no matter how small your group is, to you know, get out there and protest. And, well, that's what we're doing here. We've formed a group. We got together the first time joining, you know, backing Cindy, and we decided that we wanted to continue it. So we, it's all groups, like the Green Party, Independent, and Democratic Party, and we get together now the second Saturday of every month. We'll be out there in the rain at 1 o'clock on the boardwalk in Coos Bay, and we're hoping. We know there's other small groups along the coast that do the same thing.
There's other small groups all over America who are doing the same thing.
We're hoping that at least down the coast of Oregon we could do it at the same day.
Yeah.
It would make a strong point because, you know, there's so many things that upset me, and I do call my congressmen and my senators, and I do write letters, but this is, you know, until we can vote again, you know, and we're getting bigger, and I'll tell you, we get so many thumbs up, you know, there's always a few that are down, but Winnebagoes and people that you wouldn't expect are, you know, I would say it's probably 85 to 90% in support of what we're doing.
Yeah,
which
that's
is really
that's absolutely marvelous, Colleen, and I congratulate you on it, and thank you for calling and sharing that with us. David in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, David, something quick? David
Hello?
Is, yeah, you're live and on the air, David.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Tom.
What's up?
I really liked what you said a minute ago about people being involved in the political parties. I've been stumping the state of Texas for 2 years, and I'm finding that everywhere people want to fight back. People are sick and tired of corporate government, and they want to do something about it.
Amen. Amen. So what are you doing about it?
I'm offering myself for public service to be the next Attorney General of Texas through the Democratic Party.
Well, that's great. Let me give you a plug then, David. Is there a website where people can find out more about you and your campaign?
www.vanossfortexasag.com. I'll spell that out, all lowercase, run together. V as in Victor, A, N as in Nancy, O, S as in Sam, Far, F-O-R, texasag.com.
Good. Good on you, David. Thank you very much for calling and sharing this, that with us, and I wish you well in it. Jeremy Narby is with us now. Jeremy is a Swiss-based anthropologist and indigenous land rights activist who spent several years in the Amazon basin. Jeremy's new book, Intelligence in Nature, An Inquiry in Knowledge, talks about his experiences around the world from meeting shamans to meeting butterflies, eh?
Yep.
Okay. Jeremy, what is the intelligence you're finding in nature that's getting scientific play these days?
Well, it's still mysterious, and it's still in the early phases of discovery because we are coming out of a long period where Western knowledge has presupposed that nature did not have any intelligence.
That nature was essentially a dead machine, and if we could figure out how to move the pieces or push the levers, everything would be fine.
Right. But it turns out that the more we have a detailed and even a molecular understanding of what goes on inside cells, including our own cells, we find, for example, that in a blade of grass, for that blade of grass to grow, to send roots down, and just to be a blade of grass, its cells need to do a lot of communicating, assimilating outside information, and the messages, the signals that those grass cells send one another, some of them are identical to the ones that our own neurons send one another so that we can have this conversation.
Sure.
So,
we both evolved in the same via the same natural process. It would make a certain amount of sense, assuming that you accept evolution as some principle of value.
Yeah, well, I know there are some folks out there that really don't believe that there's any connection between human beings and the rest of the natural world, but I think that's it's kind of, you know, I respect people's beliefs and stuff, but I think that when you look inside microscopes and you take seriously not even getting onto the terrain of whether you believe in God or whether you believe in the absence of God, just looking into the microscope and seeing cells, you know, you can look at your own blood cells in a microscope, and actually cells are the same the world over. You know, they contain DNA, the information to build a human being is in the DNA inside the original cell when life gets started. I don't think that, you know, there are creationists who deny that to get a human being you need a sperm cell and an ovum to come together. And in that sperm cell and in that ovum, there is DNA, and that DNA is essentially the same molecule and the same coding system across nature. So it seems fairly obvious that on a physical, chemical, material level, there is deep kinship between us and the other species that now seems undeniable. And, you know, for example, in recent years it's been discovered that the banana genome, if you take the DNA text of a banana, half the genes it contains have equivalents in the human genome. You know, the joke being that we really are half bananas.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so it's stuff like that. Actually, science has only discovered this genome stuff in the last 10 years. The data wasn't even in yet. And so now there are these embarrassing facts that come in like that. Embarrassing.
We share 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees, for example.
Right. And so I don't think that our culture has actually integrated what it means yet, because we've presupposed for so long that we're above the rest of nature. Now, getting back to this intelligence business, well, it depends on how you define intelligence. The original meaning of the word is to choose between, intellegere. It implies the capacity to make decisions. Well, individual cells, slime molds, ants, bees are clearly integrating information and making decisions. You know, how it happens, how does a single cell actually make a decision? Well, that's something that isn't really known yet, but the evidence coming out of the labs now is that they do. So at this point, I think we're scratching our heads a little bit and dealing with the kind of we have to reevaluate the whole scene, not only the other species, but also just what kind of connection we have with them.
We're talking with Jeremy Narby. Our Bioneers segment for the day. Bioneers, by the way, a nonprofit organization founded in 1990 that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Their website, bioneers.org. Jeremy, do you have a website?
Yeah, it's in Switzerland. It's nouvelle-planete.ch, but it's mainly in French. It's a small NGO that does community development stuff in about 30 different countries.
Okay. We have about a minute and a half or so left here, Jeremy. Just very quickly, you've spent some time with indigenous people around the world. We've seen this explosion of population on the earth. You know, in 1800, there were 1 billion of us. By 1930, there were 2 billion of us. By 1960, there were 3 billion of us. By 1974, 4 billion. 87, 5 billion. 99, 6 billion. We're pushing, you know, in the direction of 7 billion. But the reality is that explosion in population has not happened among indigenous people. In fact, their numbers have been declining. But historically, they've been relatively flat in population. What do they know that we don't know?
Well, they're a very diverse bunch of people living on five continents in completely different environments. So clearly, they know a lot of different things. But one thing that I think brings them all together is that they do understand nature to be intelligent. And they do think that for human beings to live with other species, they have to listen to nature and communicate with it, and they have different techniques for doing this. This is all kind of outside of the Western worldview. The techniques for doing this are called shamanism. That's what shamanism is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so actually, yes, humans are predators. We're not going to change that, and we don't want to become prey, that's for sure, but human predation requires mediation, and this involves a conversation with nature. I think actually what's exciting about the developments in science now is that Western science is getting sophisticated enough so that we're starting to understand in some detail just how sophisticated and intelligent nature is. So that's where the coming together of the indigenous view of nature and the scientific view of nature is full of hope, I think.
And actually has the potential to save and reform humanity if we could wake up fast enough.
Yeah, well, I think it's actually already starting to happen. So the point is to try to continue encouraging efforts that are going in that direction.
Yeah, well said. Jeremy Narby, his book, Intelligence in Nature, an Inquiry into Knowledge. Jeremy, thanks so much for being with us today.
All right, thanks to you, Tom.
Our Bioneers segment for the day, Bioneers, founded in 1990, bioneers.org, their website. And Jeremy doing some great work, a fascinating, fascinating book. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. It's 21 minutes past the hour. 21 and a half, really, if you want to technically. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth of multinational corporations, they'd really rather you didn't know all about here on the True People's Radio. 21 minutes past the hour, and time for...
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, are we going to see Tom DeLay actually in handcuffs? Are we going to see him fingerprinted, a mugshot? He was initially charged with conspiracy, this in the Associated Press, initially charged with conspiracy to violate the election code. Days later, indicted on charges of money laundering and conspiracy. Now he's going to be arraigned on Friday before State District Judge Bob Perkins in Travis County. DeAnn Underwood, judge, the coordinator for the judge, said that even though Tom DeLay figured he would be able to avoid the fingerprinting and photographing things, she said, Judge Perkins believes that if God was charged with a felony, he'd have to go through the booking process, too. So, it looks like Tom DeLay is going to do the perp walk. A small matter of concern there. At the same time now, the National Park Service has begun using a new political loyalty test. This is absolutely mind-boggling. I'll tell you about that as we go on in the program. We move on along. But first, Greg Gorman is with us at the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. with a report from what's up and what's happening in our nation's capital, Greg. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, always good to be with you. The perp walk, I love how you put that. That's not actually, it won't happen in Washington. It would happen in Texas.
That's right.
But I still have to mention it because it's too good to pass up.
Can't you
see him going into a... into a police station and being, you know, and being fingerprinted and trying to keep his head up and trying to act like it's no big deal. I mean, I personally believe that I think these charges are probably a little trumped up. I do believe he probably broke the law, but I don't know if this charge will stick because of what's now being said about Ronnie Earl, that he is, you know, he's such a Democrat and this is some kind
But he's prosecuted 15 politicians in the last 20 years. 13 of them were Democrats.
Well, and that's a great point to make. All I'm thinking is, I think the damage to Tom DeLay is done not if he goes to jail or if he's found guilty, in the fact that he's been indicted. And now everyone is seeing what kind of slimy politician he has been and will be. And I'm from Texas, so I feel a little bit qualified to say. You know, we in Texas sort of know our own, and I think that he's a little bit of a slimy underhand.
Yeah, just a little bit, huh?
And also, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what we know now about Harriet Myers. You know, she turned her questionnaire in yesterday. Every nominee has to turn in a questionnaire to the judiciary to get some written answers to questions. And I've been saying this for a long time, Tom. I think that her stealthiness has nothing to do with how conservative she will or won't be. I think her stealthiness has to do with Roe v. Wade and abortion. And apparently back in 1989, she said that she supported a constitutional amendment banning all abortions. Now, I've been saying
for those that endangered the life of the mother.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I've been saying for a while, I don't know what gave me that feeling, but I've been looking at her and I've been watching some things, and I'm really going to be interested when her hearings start, and we heard now that they'll probably start the first week of November. I'm really going to be interested to see how the senators phrase the abortion questions because it's on everyone's mind, it's on everyone's lips, including James Dobson now, of course, we know, what she's going to do on Roe v. Wade, if anything, and what her philosophy is on Roe v. Wade. Of course, it should all be moot because it shouldn't matter what she believes as a person. It should matter what the Constitution says. But, of course, that's to be seen.
Yeah, and of course, keeping in mind that the first candidate that George W. Bush nominated to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, the swing vote on the abortion issue, arguably the swing vote, a swing vote on the abortion issue on the Supreme Court, was John Roberts, who now we know, at least from his arguments or from his questioning on the Oregon death penalty case, in all probability is going to take the strict, essentially the strict Catholic view of it. You could argue both the large C and the small C.
Right.
It looks like he's going to rule against the Oregon death penalty law, and looks like in all probability he would also rule against Roe v. Wade. Whether it's stare decisis or not,
well,
stare decisis, you could argue that that in 1856 you had stare decisis in Dred Scott.
Well,
but that,
exactly.
That got overturned too.
And that's always what people say. There's always a previous precedent that you could go back to that at some point has been broken to create a new law. So, you know, that
right.
sort of goes, you know, without saying. But what's interesting, and this takes me back to the Oregon case to which you're referring, is that that's such an interesting case because we get to see how the justices will vote on not only federalism, which is do states have the rights to make their own laws, but because it's such a controversial topic in the right to die, we get to see what they say about the right to die, and we get to see the morality on that issue. So that's
right.
It's going to be a fascinating case when it's decided. Of course, it's already been heard, and I think it's going to lead us into the Harriet Myers when we see how she will be discussing things like the right to die and abortion in general. Of course, she won't mention it because there are cases going before the court. As a matter of fact, as you probably know, there's an abortion case in November, Ayotte v. Planned Parenthood of New England, and that will be the first major abortion case that John Roberts will hear. Harriet Myers probably won't be on the bench by that point, but we'll get to hear what the new Chief Justice thinks.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting time. It's particularly ironic with regard to John Roberts and the Oregon Right to Die law that both of Oregon's senators, Ron Wyden, the Democrat, and Gordon Smith, the Republican, voted in favor of John Roberts' confirmation. It's a particularly tragic event. Greg Gorman, TalkRadioNews.com. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Always good to see you.
27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. And one of my fellow progressives who's a fellow plotter, Ed Schultz, with us. Hey, Ed.
Tom, good to be on with you.
It's great to have you on the program again, Ed. I understand that Armed Forces Radio is playing some games with you. And I suspect probably most of our listeners know the story, but give us a quick snapshot of it.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the opportunity to explain it to your audience because this story is not going away. I'm getting a lot of media calls from all over the country on this. You know, Tom, going back to the beginning, it all started with Senator Tom Daschle back 3 years ago when he went into the Senate Democratic Caucus and said, you know what, we're getting the tar beat out of us, not only across the country, but on Armed Forces Radio Network. And I'm getting a lot of response back to my office of people, you know, in the military saying, you don't support us. He says that's nothing further from the truth. And so they started conversations a long time ago about getting some progressive voices, or at least one, on Armed Forces Radio Network. So this has been going on for a long time. And of course, Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa took it to the Senate floor and talked about this as well and brought up what the mission was of Armed Forces Radio Network. And we have been going back and forth and negotiating with them for a long time through our syndicator to get on Armed Forces Radio Network. And
yeah, we should probably point out here, Ed Schultz, that Rush Limbaugh is on Armed Forces Radio Network, has been for many, many years, and essentially is the only voice out there that's on Armed Forces Radio.
Exactly.
The only talk voice.
Along with Dr. Laura, along with James Dobson, Focus on the Family. And that's all fine. You know, I mean, I don't think we're about yanking people off radio stations or taking people off of access to the airways. We just want some equal time. And that's what this was all about, because obviously the Democrats have got an image problem with the military right now, and they believe a lot of it stems with what's being put out on Armed Forces Radio Network.
So you were told your folks had negotiated it, you'd worked the whole thing out, and starting this week you were going to be on Armed Forces Radio right after Rush, presumably. Your day part is right after his. And then what happened?
We were given a hard start date of October 17th. And that email came to us in confirmation on September 29th. And now that's out there in the media in the Washington Post. And this is basically how they do business. Some of the shows have got contracts. Many of the shows that they carry do not. Mine, of course, did not have a contract with them, but we had an email confirmation. We had negotiated with them for numerous months. We had been given start dates previously that didn't work. But finally, I mean, there were a bunch of suggestions out there when we were going to start it and everything else. Finally, we get a hard date of October 17th. I'm promoting it on the air since the end of September. Lo and behold, they hold this teleconference last week with the president and the troops. Allison Barber is in the middle of it, and she's the higher up with the Pentagon dealing with all the communications.
She's the woman who is seen on TV coaching the troops in how they should speak to the president when they come on.
Exactly.
Right,
and,
okay.
Of course, me, like everybody else in the country, we played some of the audio of that on our show.
It was on NBC.
Yeah, it was all over. You're right, Tom. It was all over.
Yeah, and so it's not like this is some kind of left-wing conspiracy to get Allison Barber.
Absolutely.
This was on network news.
But it was 6 o'clock in the morning on Monday, the day we're supposed to start a program. The call comes from none other than Allison Barber, not an underling, not an assistant, not the head of the Armed Forces Radio Network, but the deputy of the Defense Department. I mean, it's kind of a compliment, isn't it? But anyway, so she calls and tells us, no, you're not going to be on. And my producer, Homie, says he got the call. He said, well, you know, are we going to be on when you get back from overseas? She says, I don't know. I can't answer that. Are we ever going to be on? She says, I don't know. I can't answer that either. So it looks like a get back. And yeah. You know, I'm not bitter about it. There was no financial gain at all for our show being on or off Armed Forces Radio Network. I wanted to be on there because obviously it's good promotion and good exposure, and I think it's the right thing to do to have balance on that network.
Yeah, and that's really the largest issue. I mean, don't the regulations require Armed Forces Radio to be balanced?
This is exactly what Senator Harkin brought up on the Senate floor when all of this came to a head. That's exactly right. They're mandated to have some balance. Now, my question is this. What I said about Allison Barber on the air, is it any worse than what Rush Limbaugh has said about Ted Kennedy or Hillary Clinton?
Well, even beyond that, Ed Schultz, is it any worse than Rush Limbaugh trivializing torture by the troops?
There you go. I mean,
here you got a guy on the air trivializing torture, which is against the law. It's against the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's a violation of the rules that are in the Army manual, every branch of the service.
No question about it.
It has brought this country into disrepute, and he's making jokes about it and trivializing it, and that's the guy that they're saying, oh, we'll keep this guy, but this Ed Schultz guy, we're not going to have him on, and because what?
Good question.
Yeah.
Good question. I don't know. Give me a reason.
Well,
Is it a topic? Did I say something? What is it? How can you have a confirmation? Now, listen to how they're spinning this.
Sure.
The comment in the Washington Post this morning from Brian Whitman, Pentagon spokesman, says, last night he said that Manny Levy, who sent the email of confirmation to Jones Radio about the syndicated show of Ed Schultz being on, quote, got ahead of the process. Uh-oh, we got another overzealous staffer over there.
You know? Blame it on the underlings.
That's right. There we go.
You wonder if Lenny England had something to do with it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they love that, you know.
When she wasn't running around with her dog leash, she was sending emails to Ed Schultz saying, you can get on the air with us.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be on with Oberman tonight on MSNBC. And I've gotten some other phone calls for some other media exposure on this. And, you know, Tom, here's the bottom line. We can agree, disagree. We can liberal, conservative, left, right, whatever, you know, left wing, single wing, whoever wing. The fact is, when you start squelching voices and when you start managing the message, we got problems.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm at on all of this.
Do you think, Ed, that we're coming to a time when you're going to be, in order to be on Armed Forces Radio, for example, you may have to sign a loyalty oath? I mean, are we looking back at the McCarthy era here all over again?
Good question. I mean, I really don't know what it's going to come to. We deserve an answer. I think we put together a quality show as you do. I think that we've done some good things in the radio industry. Tom, you've been in this racket a long time. You know how hard it is and what an uphill battle we've had to get one station after another to build it. We were laughed at early on. People said there was no market for this. There was no commercial viability. The fact is the industry got it wrong. There's plenty of listeners out there.
Sure.
And there's no question there's an audience and there's advertisers and it's a viable business and all of these things are coming together.
And your show is doing a great job. Yeah, and you are not, you know, a firebomb thrower. You know, I mean that as a compliment, by the way. I mean, I listen to your show. You're on the air as I'm driving home from this show, right? And here on the radio station that I work at, and You're doing a great job. You're doing a good show. You know, what's amazing to me, Ed, there aren't any liberals, there aren't any leftists left in America. The leftists were the old Marxists who believed that the government should own everything, the means of production and distribution. They were the old communists, the old Socialist Workers' Party. Joe McCarthy and Richard Nixon and that bunch, they completely got rid of the leftists in this country. There's a marginal, rather humorous fringe of leftists left over, but there really are no leftists. What we have is we have the vast American middle, which is probably 80% of Americans, who really would like national health insurance and who really would like a healthy Social Security program and who would really like a decent environment, who want a strong defense, who love and believe in their country. And then there's this weird little right wing that we used to call the right wing extremists, who have taken over the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And they have been, they have had such a disproportionate influence and power on our mass media in the United States that mass media is referring to people like you and I, who, in my opinion, and really occupy the traditional center of America, who represent true traditional American values, and they're calling us leftists.
Tom Hartman, I'm proud to follow your show. Hit that baby out of the park, brother.
Yeah. I mean, that's the rant, and it's somebody needs to be saying it to the Pentagon, because, I mean, you know, here we are. Whether you believe in the war or not, whether you think it's a good idea or not, I mean, nobody is out there saying, hey, you know, these troops are, I mean, we all support the troops. And you get folks like Rush Limbaugh on there saying, oh, those liberals, they don't support the troops. That's terrible that he's doing.
You know, Tom, I am so tired. I'm going to talk about this today. I am so tired of being positioned, being imaged, being pigeonholed as a dissenting voice.
Yeah.
I am not a dissenting voice.
We're the mainstream, Ed. We're the mainstream, I'm telling you.
Yeah, I got you. I hear you, brother.
I'm telling you. So thanks so much for being with us on the program here. Is there any specific call to action? You know, a website, anything where people, you know, or do you think people should just call their, you know, call 202-225-3121, the main number in Washington, D.C., and just say, hey, you know, how about some other voices on Armed Forces Radio?
Ed Schultz, Tom,
in particular.
Tom, I really appreciate you asking that, but here's my approach. I think people know what they need to do. I'm not going to ask them to do it. I'm not going to beg my way onto any radio station. I'm not going to beg my way onto any radio network. This is going to take on a life of its own.
You're right.
I know I'm doing the right thing. I know bringing this to the table on my show yesterday and being aggressive about it was the moral thing to do for the country, and I'm going to do it again today. And if there are people out there, great Americans, who feel like they are compelled to get involved and to do something, you know, I appreciate it. It's your country, too, not just Tom Hartman's and Ed Schultz's. I mean, I think that the pushback is going to be there, and I think this story is a long way from being over.
Yeah, well said. Ed Schultz, thanks so much for being with
Tom.
Us today, Ed. It's
thank
a big,
you very much.
Big Ed Radio is your website, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Isn't your website Big Ed Radio?
WeGotEd.com.
WeGotEd.com. Thank you very much.
You bet.
WeGotEd.com. Good talking to you. Ed Schultz. The Ed Schultz radio program and his interesting situation here with the U.S. Department of Defense. Yeah, we do need balance in Armed Forces Radio, in my opinion. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Get active, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. I'm going to drop into our live chat room. Go to TomHartman.com if you want to call. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. That's 440-THOM, 440-8466. Jeff in Everett, Washington on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Sure, what's up?
Well, I've become I used to hate talk radio, and in the last year, since Progressive Talk up here in Seattle is starring you and Ed Schultz, I've actually started listening to talk radio. So I got to admit, I've become a big fan of both your shows.
Thank you.
I'm a Navy Reserve journalist, and I'm close to retirement. Been in the active duty Navy for over 10 years. Been in the reserves now for almost another 10. And as far as what's going on with with Ed's situation with Armed Forces Radio, the whole Armed Forces Radio television system, if you take a look at the programming that has been coming out on that over the last 3 or 4 years, it has been moving more and more to the right, and any sort of moderate message, any sort of are we doing the right thing message has been disappearing more and more, especially since the completion of the invasion of Afghanistan. The yeah. reason for this is because they need to control the message to the troops. They've got to keep them very positive, because they see what happened in Vietnam when the troops would get letters from home stating about how they were seeing the killing on television. There was a really good thing last night on PBS American Experience about the Vietnam War, the escalation, and how it affected the troops, not only when they came home, but while they were over there. And with so many people in the Pentagon having served in Vietnam still, they're contractors, they're no longer generals, but they're all contractors now and advisors. Both in the White House and in the Pentagon have seen this happening, and they're trying to make sure that we stay on.
Yeah,
that.
So Jeff, it sounds like what you're saying is that you think that, or if you're on the inside, I mean, you work for a division of Armed Forces Radio, Armed Forces Media, that they feel that they have to convey to the troops a particular message that may or may not be consistent with reality?
This is exactly true. And the reason for this is that if they don't stay on top of the message, if they don't keep it on target, and if they don't keep it on subject, then a lot of these guys who are over there who are already saying, what the heck are we doing over here? They see the good things that are over there, but they're like, but they're at the point where a lot of troops over there, especially the reservists who have come back and forth a couple of times, know how bad things are over there.
Yeah, no, but I get it, Jeff. But I mean, ultimately, the bottom line here, and thank you for calling and raising this, but I mean, ultimately, the bottom line is these guys are supposed to be fighting for democracy. I mean, the whole point of having an army for a democratic republic like the United States is that they are out there fighting for democracy. Now, one of the principles of democracy enshrined in the First Amendment, but it long preceded that, was the idea of free speech and freely available information and widely disseminated news and a well-informed populace, which is necessary to have a democracy. And if we're going to say, oh, no, we're going to tightly control the information that goes to our troops, they're not going to have democracy available to them, although we want them to fight for democracy. That's the ultimate hypocrisy. That is just absolutely the ultimate hypocrisy. How dare they? Jay in Atlanta, Georgia on the line. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I assume that you take the worldcan'twait.org movement seriously?
I beg your pardon, the what movement?
You haven't heard of the website, worldcan'twait.org, that had the movement on November 2nd to get everyone to walk out of schools and businesses?
No, I've seen some information about that, but frankly, I'm not particularly well informed about it. I'm sorry. I get at least 300-400 emails a day, and probably a third of them are one movement or another that wants me to talk about it on the radio. So
right, and of course, they're obviously in the same vein as yourself and everyone, your base of listeners, who one way or the other, for one reason, we want him out, resign, impeach.
Right.
All these different things. Or some people like yourself, perhaps, or even Ed Schultz has said, it's not going to happen. Just do the best we can while he's in office. Whatever strategy you have, the point is we all agree.
Actually, I think impeachment is possible. First of all, if Bush or Cheney get indicted or are named as unindicted co-conspirators, it's even possible their own Republican Party will turn against them, although unlikely. But the other thing is if the Democrats can take the House during the midterm elections and the elections
well,
of 06,
it's entirely possible. But given that, I'm saying there is a contingent of people like ourselves who would love to see, if we could, theoretically, if we could wave a magic wand and have a genie say, Bush is out, Mr. X is in, then we'd all go, yeah, anybody to replace Bush instantaneously, like if a parliamentary system or something, we'd all be elated. But I think in the real world, obviously, we don't have genies, but I think our biggest obstacle is that we're fractured, and part of the fracture stems completely from the fact that we don't all have a name for Mr. X that we could.
No, it's not. You're missing the political reality of it, Jay. And the political reality of it is very straightforward. The Democrats or the Republicans understood it really well. They knew that Al Gore would make a very effective president if they got rid of Bill Clinton, and he would reinvigorate the Democratic Party, and that one of the worst things that could have happened to them was if they actually convicted Bill Clinton in the Senate, and he was gone, and he was no longer on the scene, and they no longer had a boogeyman. They knew that. They really didn't want him convicted. If they did, they would have gotten a conviction in the Senate. What they understood was that the process of impeachment cripples a sitting president. It cripples him. And so for a couple of years, Bill Clinton was not able to pursue the policies that he wanted. He wanted to have a national health care program. They stopped him from doing it. He wanted to be even more proactive with the environment. They stopped him from doing it. The only thing they let him do was the stuff that they wanted, the Telecommunications Act that allowed more media consolidation and NAFTA and GATT, you know, which allowed more and more and more corporate power. That was pretty much it. And so, in my mind, impeaching George W. Bush has very little to do with removing him from office, because the probability of his being removed from office is probably zero. But the process of impeachment is crippling to a politician, and therefore I think it's important. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Yes, it's time, I think, for an Enron alert.
Just before our stock did tank, we sold and took it to the bank. The workers still got screwed. It was our intention to bilk the working dude right out of his pension. We're Enron.
Oh, yes.
Dick Cheney needs power solution.
Not to mention his paycheck. And he's working for us. So here's our Enron alert for the day. The Enron accounting that this government has been run on ever since Bush came into office, where you started out Alan Greenspan, who has a tremendous history, and I don't mean tremendous as in isn't that great. I just mean, you know, big-time history in sucking up to power. The old Enron. We're Enron! Yes, indeed. Dick, Alan Greenspan, back when Ronald Reagan was president. When Ronald Reagan was president. Ronald Reagan had the lunch with this guy. I think his Alzheimer's was starting to set in. He had lunch with, Alvin Toffler? He was one of these guys. Sat down and said, Lafler sat down and says, you know, I got this curve, this supply side curve. You know, if the government has a tax rate of zero, then the government doesn't have any income because you're not collecting any taxes. On the other hand, if the government has a tax rate of 100%, so every penny anybody earns goes to taxes, you have an income of zero because nobody would work. And Reagan goes, uh-huh, yeah, that makes sense. And it does. And the guy says, therefore, I'm drawing this curve. And he draws this curve on it, this kind of bell curve on it. And he says, the top of the bell is like down around 10 or 20%. And he says, because keep in mind, when Reagan came into power, the top tax rate was 70%. And the economy was doing very well, thank you very much. The middle class was strong. 25% of America had union jobs, and another 25% had the equivalent. They had pensions. They had full medical benefits. They could put their kids through school. They had a paycheck. An average working blue-collar guy, and not to mention, you know, college graduates, they could put their kids through school. Single wage earner could support a family. That's what life was like in this country when Reagan came into office. It was the tail end of 40 years, 50 years of the golden age of the American middle class as a result of progressive or liberal or whatever you want to call it, all-American economics, brought to you courtesy of Franklin Roosevelt. And so the top tax rate was 70%, and because we, you know, and the average CEO earned 30, 40, sometimes 50 times what his lowest, most lowly paid employee made. And all of us understood that if somebody tried to earn 500 times or 1,000 times what their lowest paid employee made, that they were mentally ill, that they were greedy, that there was something wrong with that, that that was exploitative, that it's important that everybody have a share in the society, that we pay a living wage. So anyhow, Lafler says to Reagan, he says, you know, if you start cutting taxes, you're going to actually increase the revenue coming into the government. Reagan says, you're kidding. And he says, no, Jack Kennedy did it. He cut the top tax rate from 90%, where Roosevelt had it, down to 70%, and the income actually went up to the government. Now, that is true, but it wasn't because Kennedy cut the taxes. I mean, you go back to the debate that John Kennedy had with Richard Nixon. And, you know, Kennedy just laid it out. He said, you know, I'm sick and tired of my opponent distorting my record kind of a starting point. And he said that his intention was to reduce the top marginal tax rate because nobody was paying it. And Kennedy was certainly in a position to know. Because, you know, he was a multimillionaire himself. I mean, he was certainly in a position to know that. He said, nobody's paying that. So all I'm going to try and do is close the tax loopholes. I'm just going to close the tax loopholes, he said. But my opponent is constantly distorting my record. That's his right. But, you know, I'm just going to close the loopholes. And by closing the loopholes at a 70% rate, he got more money from the wealthy in America than with all the loopholes at the 90% rate. In fact, here it is. This is Kennedy and Nixon. Let me start that over again here.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
And he also said,
third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding on expense accounts.
You get that? And once again,
so in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
And so the next time, I wanted to repeat it twice. In fact, I should probably repeat it three or four times, because you are going to hear over and over and over again. You're going to hear all these cons. I've probably heard it 100 times on TV. They come, well, Kennedy lowered the top tax rate from 90% to 70%, and it increased government revenue. Well, it did, because he closed loopholes.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding on expense accounts.
And he did. And it worked. And that's how it works. So anyhow, now we have Reaganomics writ large with Bush. And they're still operating on this weird belief that if they cut the tax rates, the top tax rates for the wealthiest of Americans, and everything will be fine. Well, here's what happened. First of all, Reagan tried this. He believed Lafler. He believed these supply side. This had never been tried before in history. Nobody had ever tried it before. Well, arguably the Germans did after World War I. In order to, you know, they were stuck with the Treaty of Versailles. They had to make all these reparations. So they just ran the printing presses. Led them to hyperinflation. It cost 1 million marks to buy a loaf of bread. But nobody had ever tried this before. So they said, Reagan says, okay, I'm going to cut taxes from 70% down to 30%. That should increase government revenue. Because he believed this lie. And he cut the taxes, and guess what happened? Government revenues went down. They fell off the edge of the earth. All of a sudden, the government was in such a deficit that it was frightening. So he turns to Alan Greenspan, and he says, what can I do? What can I do? And Greenspan says, borrow the money from Social Security. That way it's a government borrowing from government, and it won't show up as part of the deficit. You won't look bad. And Reagan says, but what happens when, 30, 40 years from now, those people start retiring, they want their Social Security checks? And Greenspan says, let them worry about it 30, 40 years from now. You're worried about your own political future now. Now, I'm, imagining this conversation, but I'm not imagining the reality of what happened. Ravi Batra documents this in his book Greenspan's Fraud, that it was Greenspan's advice to Reagan that after he drove this country into debt by deficit spending because of a tax cut for the rich, that he then went to and ripped off the Social Security Trust Fund to pay for it. So now it's getting even worse. Reagan then, as Bush Jr., wants to run for election. Greenspan says, who sucks up to power, who sucked up to Reagan, he's sucking up to Bush Jr., he's a libertarian, he was initiated into the cult of objectivism by Ayn Rand. Greenspan drives interest rates down to the point where they're actually negative. The interest rates that the banks are using on federal fund rates is below the interest rate. And he drives them down to the point where housing prices start shooting through the roof because the cost to buy a house is cheaper and cheaper because most people base the cost of their house not on what the house costs but what the monthly payments are, right? So there's this boom in housing, and there's this boom in people taking the equity in their house, which is just a fantasy. It's the result of Greenspan manipulating credit interest rates so that George W. Bush's disastrous tax breaks won't create a Great Depression, at least over the short term, so he could get himself reelected in 2004. The Greenspan driving down these interest rates, and you've got all these people now borrowing money against their house on interest-only loans, adjustable-rate mortgages. Well, here today, this is your Enron moment, your Enron alert, the Enron Accountingness Administration. This is from Reuters. Residential mortgage lenders should be prepared for an increase in credit losses as interest rates rise and pull the reins on a years-long boom in the U.S. housing market, the chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said on Tuesday. Donald Powell in comments to the American Community Bankers Conference in Orlando said record home price increases have led to non-traditional mortgage products, such as loans that require little documentation or interest-only loans. But, he said, as interest rates begin to climb, borrowers will face higher debt service on these products. He says credit losses are low now, but mortgage lenders need to be prepared for higher losses. In other words, look out, guys, the sky's about to fall. It's, the Enron accounting. Look what happened to Enron when everybody figured out how their books were being done. Well, the Bush administration is doing our books the same way. They're fixing to do it to our government all over again. Reagan started it. Clinton stopped it. Bush brought it back. And it's going to bite us in the butt. 17 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful and comfortable, 'cause we were powerful and in control. Then daddy's judges came through and they appointed me the president.
Oh, yes, George.
With no precedent, Pennsylvania Avenue resident. So I entered a world that was full of complexity, far too much for me. I never got beyond dichotomy. How ironic it was that I would lead a democracy without diplomacy, in many ways an aristocracy.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, and how ironic, George, that you would buy yourself a pig farm down in Texas, call it a ranch, and not have any horses because you're afraid of horses. Welcome back. 23 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you here. 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com, our website if you want to drop by. And I'm going to get to your phone calls in just a second. I just, JFK, since I was playing a clip from JFK, I was looking at my little JFK clip collection here, and there's one that I so want to hear a Democrat say. I so want to hear a Democrat say this. And I was so proud of John Kennedy for, you know, when he said this at the time. I just have to share this. It's just a 55-second clip. Just a little piece here. John Kennedy on being a liberal.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
You get that? Then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal. It's just, I mean, what has happened to American history? You know, what has happened to American history? It's like people just, people have lost it. 1-866-440-8466. 1-866-440-THOM. David in, what is it, Blaine, Washington, David?
Yes.
Hey, David, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. Great.
Yeah, it's an honor to speak to a fellow liberal.
There you go. In the finest tradition of John Kennedy.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Hey, really quick, you know, the cancellation of Ed's show screams of a slimy agenda. Would you agree?
I mean, yeah. Well, yes and no. It's what's particularly interesting.
The only reason why I say that is because you know, we have the indictments looming for the Republicans.
Right.
You know, the lies that led to the invasion of Iraq, which was illegal.
Right.
And then if we go even further back, you know, the deadly incompetence that was leading up to the 9/11 collapse in New York City.
Yeah.
You know, so if the troops start to put those pieces together, you know, and just given, you know, given Rush Limbaugh's side, you know, but just the troops deserve or entitled to be given all the information and not just one side.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. And where I was going with my original answer to your question is, you know, is canceling Ed's show on Armed Forces Radio Network, Ed Schultz's show, who was a guest on this program in the last hour, is canceling his show part of some conspiracy to keep liberals off the air? Well, I think that, you know, for a long time they haven't wanted to have liberal voices, John Kennedy-style voices on the air. And frankly, Ed's show is, you know, one of the more moderate of the progressive voices that are out there, one of the more moderate shows. And I say that respectfully, by the way. I think he does great radio.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is that the woman who called him to inform him that he was not going to be on the air is the woman who the day before he had played the clip of rehearsing the soldiers. And that makes me think that this is something that is a personal, petty vendetta rather than some sort of large systemic thing.
But
frankly,
then exactly. So the timing of it, you know, with the indictments looming, plus the, I mean, the Republicans are falling apart. I mean, not all of them, but just I feel sorry for the ones that are the of the more liberal Republicans. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's a grim one. And David, thanks a lot for sharing it. This is a. We are at a time, we are at a junction point or a turning point or a pivot point in American history right now. It's a very important time to be alive and to be active. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, we can't get fooled again.
People think I'm a moron. What if they only knew the depth of my evil genius? And I can be stupid whenever I need to, yeah. In my midnight confessions, I reveal my imperial secrets.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes. Coming up about 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com. And click on the live chat if you want to drop into our chat room. You can click on the blog and message board if you want to drop into our message board and participate there. Click on articles on democracy if you want to read my regular rants on topics. And let's go back to the phone lines here. 1-866-440-THOM-8466, also known as Billy in Santa Cruz, California, listening on KRXA, one of the finest radio stations in America, where you can also hear Peter B. Collins. Hey, Billy, what's up?
Yeah, Peter B.'s good.
Yeah, he's great.
It's wonderful to have that new liberal radio station in our area.
Yeah, and to have local talent on it.
You bet.
You know, having Peter B. doing that show there, and I mean, Peter B. Collins is in my opinion, one of the best national quality radio talents. He and I were on IE America Radio Network together, you know, years ago, and to have him doing a regional show there now, and it's starting to be nationally syndicated, I know, but it's originating right there in that station. You guys are really, really fortunate.
You know, there's two great Peters on radio. One is Peter B. Collins. The other is Peter Werby.
I agree. And Peter Werby's working out of Detroit. Yeah, and Peter Werby's working out of Detroit now. Yeah, and all three of us were on IE America Radio years ago, back when Air America was just a dream.
And but, I used to listen to you back then. I'm sure you remember.
Oh, yeah. You used to call in. So.
And that's part of my question.
We go back a long way. Here we go, Billy,
you know,
don't we?
We do. And we were right. And so here's my first question to you. Am I supposed to wait for my Republican friends to call to apologize, or should I call them, laugh, and say, I told you so?
About specifically which outrage this week?
Oh, this is the Bush hatred. In other words, I was labeled so early on, and it was true about me, and I never minded the label, but they used it pejoratively, like, you're just a Bush hater. Yeah.
Right.
And the problem with that is what exactly? I see too clearly, or I'm so far ahead of your ability to see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer to your question.
Yeah.
I, you know, it's like,
that was a joke.
Yeah. I mean, how many of us were Tojo haters? You know, it's that's an imperfect analogy, but you get it anyway.
Well, sometimes I mean, like with a guy like Reagan, because he's sort of a nice, genial guy, you can have second thoughts about your question about how bad he was. But with Bush, not for a second have I thought he was a good guy. I mean, it was just clear to me from day one what he was about, what he came to do. And damn it, I was right, you know.
Well, and the thing about Reagan that most Americans don't get, and it's so tragic that the conservatives have done such a good job of rewriting history, is that Reagan did enormous damage in California as governor of California, imposing a right-wing agenda on that state, making the University of California no longer a free institution, and thus inhibiting and shutting down an awful lot of social mobility in that state. And when he became president of the United States, I mean, first of all, in a very questionable fashion, having his vice president and his campaign manager, William Casey, cut a deal with the Ayatollah to hold the hostages so Jimmy Carter would lose.
That's
so first of all,
he
comes in as a stolen election, and then he perpetuates 8 years of an incredible right-wing agenda, driving America. America had never seen a $1 trillion deficit before Ronald Reagan came along. When he left, it was almost $3 trillion. He did incredible harm to this country, and nobody talks about it. I think he and there were more senior officials in the Reagan administration, not just indicted but convicted of major crimes. We're not talking about misdemeanors but felonies, than in any other administration in the history of the United States. And he's still considered by many to be a good president. And I consider him one of the most atrocious presidents we ever had. He was, in terms of performance, probably one of the best we ever had at performing the role of president.
When you hire an actor, you get a performance.
There you go.
I was shocked, by the way, to hear that Ed was thrown off the radio, and to think that it was that same woman who did it. That's sort of nice that the Bush administration was nice enough to say, hey, you know, they messed with you. Here, you have some joy. Go mess with them back.
Well, that's my question is, did she just take this upon herself because she was in a position where she could do it? Or did the Bush administration say, here's a stick, go hit him with it?
You know the answer to that.
Well, actually, I don't.
Well, I do, because the fact is that every time the Bush administration has run up against someone who's questioned them on policy, they've attacked them on policy? No.
Yeah, well, usually they attack their wives.
They attack their wives. They attack their characters.
That's
right.
They
make up stories. But what they never do is actually argue about the issue because they're always wrong.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to throw that out there. And then I wanted to ask you a question about Ron Wyden.
Sure.
You were talking about, is there any Democrats left or is there any liberals left? When I started watching Ron Wyden, he was a representative, and he was going after the tobacco people before anybody else was, and he wasn't letting them lie to him, and he was a stand-up guy, and now he's a senator, and you mentioned that he voted for Roberts, and I was troubled by that, and I want to know, you're in Oregon, is he the great guy I thought he was? I used to think he was the only guy in Congress I could trust. Can you give us a short chat on...
I'm trying to figure out Ron Wyden myself, Billy. He's been good enough, and by good enough, I really mean that. He's been good enough to come on my local program with some regularity and answer my questions and answer callers' questions, which is something that Gordon Smith won't do, that Darlene Hooley won't do, that Wu won't do, David Wu won't do. These are, you know, Gordon Smith is a Republican, the rest of them are Democrats. A lot of Democrats won't come on my program and talk to people because they don't want to be confronted about, you know, why did you vote on the bankruptcy bill, or why did you support CAFTA, things like that. So Ron Wyden will at least come on and have a conversation with me about these things, although he did vote for CAFTA. And he came on my program, and he defended his vote. And I said, hey, you know, you're never going to convince me, and obviously I'm not going to convince you. So, but, you know, we've both made our points. And it's interesting. A couple of days before the vote, I interviewed Maria Cantwell of Washington State on my program because on the morning, I do a morning show before this national show, and the morning show is on AM 620 KPOJ, which is a 25,000-watt clear channel station out of Portland that reaches well into Washington State. And Maria Cantwell was on the program, she was undecided about Roberts, and I said, you know, does it, and she was essentially kind of saying the line, as I recall. I mean, I don't recall our conversation word for word, but most of the senators that I talked to about him, they would say these things that were the Republican talking points. Even the Democrats would say them because they believed them to be true, that the guy was not partisan, that he wasn't a partisan hack, that he didn't have an agenda, that he really was just a lawyer and a constitutional scholar. And I said, well, doesn't it trouble you, and again, I'm paraphrasing from probably bad memory, but I said, doesn't it trouble you that he went down to Florida on his own nickel, he provided advice to Jeb Bush about how Jeb Bush, even if Al Gore in the 2000 election, even if Al Gore won the election, Jeb Bush could still send Republican electors to Washington, D.C., and then he advised the lawyers in the Bush v. Gore case. He was down there with John Bolton trying to stop the vote, and then he advised the lawyers in the Bush v. Gore case about how to argue before Judge Justice Rehnquist, for whom he used to clerk, and in fact, they role-modeled it, they role-played it, and he played the role of Rehnquist, and those same lawyers then went to Washington, D.C. and successfully argued that the count should be stopped because it would cause, if the count continued, it would cause irreparable harm to their client, George W. Bush. I said, doesn't it trouble you that he was so deeply involved in such a partisan activity? And Maria Cantwell said, I didn't know that. And the next day she came and she, you know, it was genuine. I'm not saying this to put her down. I have tremendous respect for her. And the next day she came out and said that she was opposing his nomination. And I thought that was marvelous. And I don't know if I had anything to do with that or not. I'm not trying to claim that I did. But my point is that I think, number one, it's a tragedy that across the Senate, I was having this conversation with Mark Crispin Miller the other day, or David Sirota, one or the other, and about how few senators, you know, how what kind of a filter they have to have, because so much information is coming in that very often they don't really get the information they need. So anyhow, you know, I had this conversation with Maria Cantwell, and she came out against him. She was the only member of the Northwestern delegation of these two states, Washington and Oregon, who voted
against
him.
Did Ron Wyden say why he was going to vote for him?
The day of the vote, an hour after Ron Wyden announced he was going to vote for Roberts, he came on my program.
Wow.
And at that point, I asked him the Florida question. And he sounded surprised, but at that point, he couldn't back up. And so I said, why are you going to vote for the guy? And he said, well, I privately met with him, and he privately assured me, essentially, that he's on our side with death with dignity, that he's not going to, you know, he's not going to be a right-wing nutcase. And I'm thinking, you've been suckered, Ron. You've been suckered. This guy is one incredibly effective liar.
Yeah, he's no doubt a pro. You know, when he said the words, if the Constitution says that the little guy wins, the little guy wins. If the Constitution says the big guy wins, the big guy wins. The question that should have followed up on would have been, so, the Constitution allowed for slavery. As a Supreme Court justice, you would have done nothing to end slavery any sooner than every state was ready to, sir?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's and
why
actually,
can I figure out the question to be asked, and my senators aren't man enough to do it? So
well,
bring this back to Ron Wyden.
This
the reason
is,
I ask is,
I'm
looking for a candidate to run, in 08. I'm not happy with.
You mean for president?
Yeah.
Okay, here, Ron Wyden is not on my screen, I'm sorry, because he voted for CAFTA and he voted for Roberts, and, you know, I'm going to support him as a senator because I think we need a Democrat here in Oregon, but I would not support him for president of the United States. But I'll tell you the people who I would, in a heartbeat, I would support John Edwards. In a heartbeat, I would support Al Gore. In a heartbeat, I would support Howard Dean. And in a heartbeat, I would support Barbara Boxer. There are four strong Democrats, and any one of those four, I believe, could win the presidency of the United States.
So you agree with me, Kerry is not an acceptable candidate next time out.
I don't think so, no.
And Hillary is a problematic candidate next time out.
That's correct. Hillary is too close to the Democratic Leadership Council, in my opinion. She's too much of a DLC Democrat. And with me, unfortunately, I suspect that I speak for many Democrats in America. When John Kerry did not fight the battle in Ohio after he said he would, that was the end of it for me. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Tom. And if you find my free speech, let me know.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Billy. Good talking to you. Always good talking to you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, get out there, get active. Hey, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the top of the hour, coming up on the end of the show. Thank you so much for being with us today. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM, and Amy in San Diego, California, on the line. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Last night I went to a George Lakoff lecture, and it was really, really depressing. He was telling us that the day after Katrina, he said it was the perfect opportunity for Democrats to stand up and say, this is why this type of government doesn't work. And he said he wrote...
you mean this is why this kind of administration doesn't work?
Right. Yes, I'm sorry. This administration. And
The
Bush administration. He had sent letters to like all the Democratic leaders saying, these are the talking points you need to use. And not one of them was doing it. They're all saying... You know, they're having enough trouble. Let's just let them stew in their own juices. And he said, if you don't do this, they're going to come back and say, see, this is why government doesn't work. And that's exactly what they're doing.
That's right.
Why won't the Democrats listen to people? I am just so frustrated.
You know, Amy, I don't know the answer to the question. I'm sorry. I'm not privy to the inner circles of the Democratic Party. What I can tell you is that, you know, I've spoken with Howard Dean about this a couple of times, broadly.
Yeah.
And he, I think, came to, and I'm not putting words in his mouth here, and I'm not talking out of school. This is more my take on what he said than what he said.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that he came to a sudden and perhaps horrifying realization when he became head of the Democratic National Committee, or, you know, the DNC, the Democratic Party, that that Will Rogers was right. When Will Rogers said, I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat. And, and in a way, it's the beauty of the Democratic Party that it really and truly does have, a lot of diversity and a lot of inclusiveness, and people don't march lockstep, and they don't easily take kindly to hierarchical instruction and somebody like George Lakoff saying, you will do this because I said it because I know that it's the best thing, even if he's right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's the upside of the Democratic Party. The downside of it is that when somebody comes along who is right, they don't follow along in lockstep.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. The other problem, the much larger problem, frankly, that I'm seeing in the Democratic Party,
mm-hmm.
and the reason why I think it's so important that people like you and I, Amy, show up at Democratic Party meetings. I'm showing up at a fundraiser for the Washington County Democrats, for example, here in Oregon, either the next week or the week after. And I do these things, with the local Democratic parties. I did one over in Yamhill County a couple of weeks ago and endorsed a candidate, Sal Peralta. The reason I do these is I think that unless what we call progressives or liberals, what I would call traditional American values folks, unless we take back the Democratic Party by actually participating in it, then the DLC Democrats, the Republican Light Democrats, the corporatist Democrats, are going to continue to hold considerable power in the party, and I'd say they hold at least half the power in the party now.
Absolutely.
And there is a battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party that is not going on for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. There was a battle and soul for the heart and soul of the Republican Party starting in arguably 1962, 63, that peaked for a little while with 64 with Goldwater's nomination. Then they crashed and burned and then reemerged in the mid-70s after Nixon, where they literally thought the party was dead. I mean, 1975, I knew Republicans who thought that the Republican Party within 10 years would be replaced by something entirely new, by the Whigs would be back or something.
Yeah.
The party was toast.
Yeah.
And instead, a bunch of conservatives got together and said, we're going to take over this party. We're going to do it step by step, methodically. We're going to start at the grassroots.
Sure,
we're going to do it from the bottom up. And that's what, and there's a lot of us now working to do the same thing with the Democratic Party.
Yes.
And that's what needs to be done. That's the move on agenda. That's the God's Politics. The author of that book, I'm forgetting his name, but you know who I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And I mean that is the work that we need to be doing. We need to be taking back the Democratic Party from the grassroots up. Absolutely. Amy, thanks for the call. I got to move along. Great to hear from you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Amy. Tony in Seattle, you're live and on the air on the Tom Hartman program. Hey, Tony.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate you earlier playing those clips. From
JFK?
JFK, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm born in 72, so unfortunately I just grew up hearing about the man and seeing him, seeing him on television and reruns. So, I try to listen intently the main clip they play by him is What You Can Do for Your Country.
And, right, from his inaugural.
Also, I really wanted to draw this parallel between George being afraid of horses and talking about the cavalry's coming. I was wondering, do you think he's projecting his fears on the people in when the catastrophe happens, seeing how he's afraid of horses? Why would he tell them that, the cavalry was originally on horses?
Yeah.
He must know that.
Projecting his fears. I mean, here's
September the 11th.
This is just from George W. Bush's Republican National Committee speech, what was supposed to be his uplifting speech. Here's just a few little clips for you, Tony.
Evil. The world will drift toward tragedy. Tragedy. May God bless you. Evil. God. Iraq. Afghanistan and Iraq. Evil. Darkness. God. The continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. September. The continuing danger. We have fought the terrorists across the earth.
I mean, it just goes on and on.
That's all he talks about is fear.
Yeah, I think he's a very fearful guy. I think he's a very, on 9/11 when he was hopscotching, whatever the word is, all over the United States. I think it was because he was terrified. It took him a whole day to get back to Washington.
Tom, I'm going to let you get to your other callers, but I learned so much from you. Please don't stop educating us. I'm dumb to a lot of the stuff out here until I hear you tell us the first time, and, man, people listen to you. Listen to Tom.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Tony. I appreciate the call. Yeah. Made my day. Good to hear from you.
Saddam Hussein, we saw a threat. Terror threat.
Come on, George. You really want to scare us, George.
Is that really?
George, give it a break. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll see you again, same time, same place tomorrow.
You're defeating the terrorists. We battle in Afghanistan and Iraq. Resurrection.
Do good, my friends.
Saddam Hussein's secret police, sadistic punishment, mass graves, terrorists, radical ideology.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.